Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors. Welcome to this episode of The Victory Show. If this is the first time you're joining us, I'm Rachel League with Bestseller by Design. Our founder, Travis Cody, is the bestselling author of 16 books, and we've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own bestselling books as well. Through that journey, we've discovered a fascinating pattern. Most businesses really struggle to break past the seven-figure revenue mark. On this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they used to scale way past that mark so you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting now. Today's guest is James Bates, an accomplished CEO, entrepreneur, investor, and board member with a remarkable track record of creating and leading high-growth technology companies. James is the founder and CEO of AdVNow Medical, the world's first fully automated medical visit platform powered by artificial intelligence and augmented reality. From conceptualizing the idea and writing the foundational patents to raising over $23 million in capital and building a world-class team, James has led AdVNow from vision to execution. He also serves as general partner of Option Agent AI, a fintech hedge fund using AI to deliver market-leading returns, and is the managing partner of the family office fund titled A Big Capital, investing in startups, real estate, and fintech. Previously, he led a $1 billion business unit at Freescale, now known as NXP, focused on autonomous vehicle technologies, and earlier in his career, drove $500 million in rapid growth while founding the Asia-Pacific region for Silicon Labs. James is a 9-time patent holder, fluent in Japanese, and serves on multiple boards, including Positioning Universal and Arizona State University's College of Nursing and Health Innovation. With a master's in electrical engineering from BYU, a deep love of innovation, and a passion for scaling transformative ideas, James continues to shape the future of healthcare, AI, and venture capital. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
So let's take it back to the beginning. Tell us, what first sparked your interest in technology and innovation?
Well, this goes all the way back to maybe when I was a kid. In my house, my dad was very busy. He worked many hours. So it was essentially my mom with 5 kids. And when anything would break around the house, I was the guy who was assigned to fix it. And so my job was to figure out how things worked and fix them. Well, early in my life, technology was a little less advanced than it is now, seeing as I'm 53. There was a lot less electronics. As I got older, electronics became more and more prevalent. And the one thing I realized is that I could understand mechanically how things worked, but I didn't understand how electronically things worked. And so that's what kind of drove me into the electrical engineering side of engineering, really just to understand how the world worked.
And is that intellectual curiosity something that your family encouraged in you? Do you think it just came from within?
Definitely. My mother was a key believer in education. She, as she raised us, everything was about, well, you could learn how to do that. Isn't that interesting? She would mandate we read as much as we watch TV. So if we wanted to watch an hour of TV, it meant we had to read an hour. And as I grew up, of course, as a kid, I thought that was tremendously unfair. But as I grew up, I realized what a blessing it was to have a mother who, she was a college professor, and she basically taught me the joy of learning and the joy of understanding. And that curiosity drove within me really the desire to make things better. As I view the world really with an optimization lens. Okay, I'm going from position A to position B. There's 5 routes to get there. Which is the most optimum one? And I'm sitting here going through all of them in my mind, depending on the time of day, how many cars are on the road, how many lights there are. And it's almost a sickness, I suppose. But that's how I lead my whole life. And so whenever I look at any problem in engineering, it really goes back to that foundational drive of, hey, this is great. Can you make it better? This is broken. Can you fix it? This is what I want to accomplish. How do you do it? And solving that mystery is really what is enjoyable to me.
Tell us a little bit about AdVNow Medical and what inspired you to start this business as opposed to trying to build this in an existing corporation.
Sure. You know, previous to AdVNow, I had the opportunity to run a $1 billion business in self-driving vehicle technologies. And I really enjoyed that job. But when we sold, you know, it was a great opportunity to exit. And it was my time to retire. But being only 45 years old, I didn't really look at it as a time to go play golf. I don't think that's what would bring me joy in life, although I do like golfing. I just don't like it that much. And so I decided that I would do something different. However, the employment contract that I had with Freescale at the time had a very, very strict non-compete. And that meant really that I could do anything that I wanted to do as long as it was something that I've never done before, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
So I looked at healthcare really as one of the biggest issues of our time. And, you know, the ACA or Affordable Care Act had just passed, and half the country loved it and half the country hated it. But one thing that was for certain was that healthcare was bankrupting families, governments, and companies. It was a massive burden that nobody knew how to fix. And so I figured, seems like a great opportunity to dig in and try to solve a problem. My initial thought was I would just buy some medical practices and roll them up together and maybe do a small private equity type of engagement. And so I started, got with a banker and started looking at businesses that were for sale. Well, after looking at about 30 different entities, I was shocked to see that none of them were good businesses. Medical practices are tough. And if you start normalizing the P&L, and what that means is you take the physician, you put them as a W-2, you make them an employee instead of an owner, and then you pay them a salary that they could make working for their local hospital. When you do that, 50% of the practices were actually money losers. They weren't money makers. And so the businesses themselves were defunct from day one as real businesses. As a financial buyer, I mean, that breaks it. You can't buy a business that looks like that. And so I took a step back and I thought, okay, well, I can't come in and buy any of these businesses because the businesses don't fundamentally work. So I went and told the people I spent time with, explaining to them that why I can't buy your business. And I got an interesting response from a person who ran a chain of urgent cares at the time. He looked at me and he says, look, James, I know my business is broken, right? I don't need you to tell me. This is something I already know. And I'm like, okay, apologize. Thanks. But he goes, what I do need is help fixing it. Can it be fixed? And I'm like, well, I don't know if it can be fixed. What I do know is from a financial standpoint, forward-looking P&L standpoint, it's broken. But let me find out. I know nothing about healthcare. So I approached it with what's called a Six Sigma cost analysis. And for those of you who went to business school out there, you've heard of this. And if you haven't, essentially what it means is you do a time and motion study, walk in with a stopwatch, and you measure every single motion that happens in the production of the widget that you're creating. In this example, it's a medical encounter. And you look at anything that is unnecessary, any movement, any action, anything that's unnecessary. I actually created a spreadsheet that was about 3,000 lines long of every single movement in that medical practice.
Wow.
And the end results of that study is what led to the founding of Advenow Medical. And that is namely, physicians spend roughly 70% of their time doing things that have nothing to do with their medical license. In my previous life, I was responsible for a factory that had over 7,000 people working in it. But then I had a team of designers and a team of engineers and a team of executives. This would be like me taking my highest paid executive and putting him on the assembly line in that factory for 2/3 of his day. Who would do that? Nobody. But somehow in healthcare, that's the norm. Well, you'd say, well, that's crazy, James. It shouldn't take an engineer like you to figure it out. No, it doesn't. But the reality is that there's reasons physicians are the ones that end up being the clerks of the practice. And that is because it takes medical knowledge, it takes insurance or payer knowledge, and then it also takes regulatory knowledge. And physicians are the ones that learn that through experience, but they don't have to be the ones that do it. And you know what? You could make an artificial intelligence that does that. And that's what Advenow Medical does. We use artificial intelligence to completely automate the medical practice by eliminating that 70% of clerical work that physicians do during their day. And practices that adopt us, they see their profitability go up by roughly 1,000%. Low single digit EBITDA, which is low single digit net profit of about 3%, goes up to over 30%, dramatically changing the business, making it into a profitable business, and fundamentally changing medicine for the better.
Wow. I mean, those are some incredible stats. And Part of what I love, both in your description of the business and how you even approached this idea and validating it, sounds like you are a very data-driven person, and that's really how you got conviction in it. Take me back to the early team in the early days of AdVNOW. What did that look like? Were you working alone? Because I know you wrote the patents, you raised the capital, and you recruited that initial team. But how did that team come together?
Yeah, really, American Express did us a great favor back in the day when we were founded. So they decided that they had a team that they used to build their complete tech stack. And this was all done in Arizona here originally with American Express. They hired a new head of their, a new CTO who came in and decided that he was going to fire the whole team and outsource it. And so a whole team of very experienced executives who understand AI, understand deep tech, understand process became available. So my very first CTO was one of the earliest tech people in American Express, and he was just perfect for the job. I have to thank American Express for that.
So you probably had a lot of trust in him having that prior existing relationship. And was it just the two of you for a while, or at what stage did you start to not only scale the business, but also scale the team?
Yeah. So we started scaling the team almost immediately. It took us roughly 2 years to build the platform. We had a team of as many as 100 people at one time. The AI itself mimics a physician's brain. And this is before the world of ChatGPT, right? We were generative AI before generative AI was cool. And so we had to develop a natural language processor. It's read all available peer-reviewed literature, extracted the relationships between symptoms and illnesses, illnesses and treatments, treatments and outcomes. And that created a knowledge graph. I had to hire teams of experts, doctors who come in who know which peer-reviewed literature is better. That ranks it. That becomes our inference engine. And that whole process was a very expensive, long process. So we were able to release the product before ChatGPT was released, of course. But it was a heavy engineering job in the beginning.
And so at what point from the ideation to making it a more viable business did you go out and raise the capital? And how was the capital raising process to enable you to grow the team so quickly?
Well, originally, I went and did the normal Silicon Valley, you know, Sand Hill Road for the startup people who understand that area in the Bay Area run, right? I ran through every major VC and I got a couple of term sheets. When they heard the story, they thought it was a reasonable startup to fund. And so that was my initial go. However, in those days, being located in the Bay Area was key for many of these venture capital firms. And so I got a term sheet that said, James, we will fund you, but you have to move to Palo Alto and, you know, you have to take some of our people, which as a VC, as a guy who's invested in many businesses myself, I understand that argument, quite frankly. But my family was not excited about moving back to the Bay Area. We had lived there before we moved to Arizona and they wanted to stay. And so initially I funded it myself. I put a couple million dollars into AdVNOW before I raised my first money. And from there, I raised money, you know, almost immediately. I started a fundraise as we were hiring people and developing the initial technology, you know, simultaneously.
And what do you think was the key to securing the capital that you needed to scale?
It's really just understanding a story, right? You have to understand the why. Why are you developing this product? Who is going to pay for it? And why will they pay for it? So if you can clearly articulate those things, and of course, you have to be credible in your ability to create the technology. That's kind of, you know, table stakes, if you will. Then you can raise money. You know, I've raised at this point, there's $38 million into AdVNOW. I'm about 10 of that is mine. So, you know, there's $28 million from other people and funding from the government as well. We've gotten NIH grants through this process. But raising that money is never easy. People don't part with checks of that size, you know, without lots of diligence. But at the same time, if your story is solid, you can do it. And so you just have to be persistent. You have to make sure your story is clean. You have to make sure you have customers who believe in you and you have a team that can execute.
And how did you hone that story? Have you always been a natural storyteller? Did you work with someone? It sounds like getting that really crystal clear was a key unlock for you.
Definitely a key unlock. You know, I've been running businesses for my whole career. My initial job out of school, I worked for Bell Laboratories. Before the engineers on the call who actually remember what Bell Laboratories is, it was the research arm of AT&T when AT&T was a monopoly. So you could almost think of it as Google Labs is for Google today, or Facebook Labs for Facebook, or something like that, right? A very highly profitable company that was well protected. Its monopoly was well protected by the government, but the government forced them to invest a certain amount of money into R&D. AT&T was involved in inventing the internet. It was involved in inventing radar, inventing semiconductors. The core research for all of those inventions was done by Bell Labs. So as an engineer out of school, that was my dream job, right? So I was able to join and be a research development and work on the world's first digital cell phone chipset. I moved to Japan. And when I was in Japan's Bell Labs organization, they actually shut down the R&D being done in Tokyo. And the person who was in charge of the sales and marketing for the region approached me and said, look, James, rather than you going back to, you know, Pennsylvania or New Jersey to work at Bell Labs headquarters, why don't you stay in Asia, but move to business development? And at that time, I had no idea what that meant really, but he was offering me a big increase in my international pay package. And so I'm like, you know, it seemed cool, so why not? But I, quite frankly, I didn't really know what I was getting into. And my job was to find technologies that were done in the labs and then find a customer who wanted to use them and draft a definition document for those products. That really trained me. In those days, this goes all the way back to the 90s, of course, if you have a Bell Labs name card, you could walk in and meet the CEO of Sony. You could meet the CEO of Samsung. You can walk into any large company in Asia, which is where I was located, and they would meet with you because you had the Bell Labs card. That calling card gave me access to engineers, research, where we were able to build over $200 million worth of business in 2 short years. And that really trained me. And so after that, I joined Silicon Labs, where I founded the international operations for them. And I was able to do the same thing, walking into these very established companies, bringing technology that they've never seen before that will add tremendous amounts of value, and then defining that value, selling it to them and configuring it for their applications. So I've kind of done that my whole career. After that, I moved to the Bay Area, worked for a company named Maxim, where I was in charge of the Internet of Things activity for the company. And we did everything from Nests, you know, or Apple Watches or things like that, you know, to cell phones that have proximity sensors. I mean, we were involved in almost all activities in Internet of Things. Then when I moved to Arizona with Freescale, we essentially were in charge of defining what the self-driving vehicle looks like, what electric vehicles look like, and the core technology for those, and just walking into companies and saying, hey, we have this tech, you have this problem, and this is the way to fix it. And being that leader in the technology space, I've just had the opportunity to do that over and over and over again throughout my career. And it's really what's allowed me to do the business that I do today.
Hmm. Yeah, your experience is so varied. You know, you've led billion-dollar business units, you've led startup teams and kind of everything in between. And what I'm hearing is that because you had the technical background, people believed in you, and then your ability to communicate that was really the key to marrying the two and sort of increasing your own success as a leader. Are there other leadership principles that you've seen stay consistent throughout your varied career?
Absolutely. I mean, there's, from a leadership principle, I believe in really kind of three fundamentals. The first is you have to lead by example. If you're asking people to do something that you're not willing to do yourself, and you're not willing to demonstrate that you will do yourself, you're going to have trouble having people follow you. It doesn't matter how great a story you tell, although storytelling is very important in leadership roles as well. You have to be able to lead by example. And the second is the storytelling. You have to be able to articulate the why. And I go back to my Silicon Labs days. My team that we hired originally, we went from zero to about 200 people in the Asia Pacific region over my time there. And as you're hiring them and they're working literally 100-hour weeks every week, you have to be able to explain the why. And it's not just about, hey, you're going to make a ton of money off of stock. And we all did, right? I mean, that we all got paid. But it can't be all about the money. It has to be about the change in people's lives that you're making with technology, how you're helping your customers, and why that matters to the world. And as a leader, if you can't articulate the why in a way people can understand and the way people can get behind, then you're also going to have trouble having them follow you. And then the last is really just hard work. I mean, when you get to a certain level in companies or a certain level in your career, everybody's smart, right? I would love to say that I have some genius brain that, you know, is an IQ 50 points higher than everybody else. It's just not reality. Everybody around me is a genius. So what the difference is, how hard am I willing to work? And if you're willing to go that extra mile, always, if you're willing to work hard, then that defines a great leader, because that's what people want to believe in. Somebody who's passionate about their job to the point that they can always take on another task.
Yes, that concept of motivation that goes beyond pay and really speaking to something deeper in people and connecting with them emotionally and getting them emotionally excited about the mission of the company that you're working towards, I think is a really valuable takeaway. And as you're thinking about building out a team, how do you know that you have the right team in place for high growth execution?
Yeah, so I hire for three things in a specific order. And it's really interesting because in my career, this order hasn't always been the same. And I've seen consequences of it sometimes, right? Number one, I hire for IQ. I want people who are inherently smart and curious. And if they're not inherently smart and curious, then they're usually not a good fit. So what do I mean by smart and curious? As I'm interviewing somebody and they're telling me about what they do, I ask them why they did it that way. If it's an engineer and they're telling me about maybe some circuit that they designed, then I'll go back in my brain of circuit design many years ago, and I will ask them an alternative method of doing it. And I'll ask them why they didn't do it that way. Or did they consider it? What were other ways they could have done it? What are the trade-offs? You know, wanted to make sure that they thought about what they did and they didn't just follow directions. Because in a small company, more than a big company, I mean, although big companies also want great people, but in a small company, you have to have great people. And so you have to have people that know why they do things. And so because you can't tell them every little step, they have to figure out so much on their own. They need to know why. They have to have that curiosity. So step one, IQ, curiosity, that mental, you know, inherent desire has to be required in those employees. And number two is really attitude, right? You can't hire somebody who is a super genius, but, you know, they like to smoke dope for 3 days out of the week, you know, and they just, they don't have that. Not only am I smart and not only am I curious, but I care enough to go the extra mile. I care enough to be able to do what it takes. Because quite frankly, what it takes many times in a startup is painful. It takes long hours. It takes a lot of pain. And you have to have that attitude of, I'm willing to do what it takes. You know, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to be successful. And that attitude, it's many times hard to interview for. So you really just have to ask people's experiences and have them explain their experiences as you're trying to root that out. But that's one of the harder things to interview for. But that's definitely what we look for. And then number third is experience. You know, when you're hiring somebody, and I have like the leader of my engineering team right now is a 26-year-old, you know, I say young kid, he probably would be insulted with me saying that way. But, you know, he's a super smart guy, but AdvNow was really his first real job, if you will. And so when I ask him to do something, he's intellectually curious. He's willing to do what it takes. He checks those first two boxes really well, but he's never done anything like this. And so many times he'll get it wrong, right? And so I I have to take on the role of a very strong mentor to allow him to be more efficient in his job so the iterations of getting it wrong are less, right? And so I do hire for experience, but only if they have number one and number two, right? They have the intellect, they have the curiosity, and they have the attitude. Then I do look for experience because it makes it easier for me. I have to mentor less if there's somebody who comes in with the right experience off the bat. Now, surprisingly, or unsurprisingly, if you will, people who have all three of those usually are paid extremely high salaries because Amazon's always willing to pay them more, right? Those guys work for large corporations and they make easily $500,000 a year just in salary and bonus. And so as a startup, you can't always afford that. So you end up doing a lot of mentoring.
Makes sense. And sounds like patience is a key element as well as you are trying to scale quickly, you're onboarding new team members, and you have to keep all of those factors in consideration and making sure that you give them the soft elements to complement what you can offer on a compensation standpoint.
Absolutely.
So as you think about building AdVNOW, were there any hiccups as you were scaling, and how did you overcome those moments?
Well, our biggest hiccup was really the pandemic. You know, our initial focus when we founded the company was what you would call retail health. It's a very narrow area of medicine. And we developed our platform, our automation platform, specifically around Safeway grocery stores, CVS MinuteClinics, things like that. The great thing is that we had interest from all of the large players. CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, Safeway, Albertsons. I mean, you could go down the list. They were all extremely interested. You know, I had unicorns dancing in my brain where this is going to be a $1 billion business. We had 28 locations opened by beginning of March of 2020. And we actually had scheduled to have over 1,000 opened by the end of 2020. And so I was really tremendously had, you know, unicorns in my brain. I mean, It was going to happen. Pandemic hit. And when the pandemic hit, the first thing Safeway grocery stores did is shut them all down. They're like, we don't want sick people in our stores. Yeah, that's not going to work. And then CVS said, we're not focusing on MinuteClinics anymore, right? We were planning to use AdVNOW in all these MinuteClinics, but hey, we don't care about MinuteClinics anymore because we don't want sick people in our stores. And so it really forced us to pivot. And we went from retail medicine originally to health systems, you know, large hospital systems, because that's where the real demand was. However, doing the level of AI automation in a large health system is a big lift because there's so many groups, so many processes that need to be automated, and really so many people that are survive by the system being broken, right? That they don't want to fix it. And so we have since pivoted again to smaller medical practices, and we're ramping like crazy. So we finally get that unicorn reality. It's coming up and we're really excited about the growth, but it's taken a couple of pivots to get there in our go-to-market approach.
Yes. And I'm sure big learnings at every turning point. The important thing is that when COVID hit, You found out a new way to adjust your business model and keep pushing forward. As you think about Victory now compared to how you defined it earlier in your career, has it evolved?
Absolutely. You know, early in my career, I was 100 miles an hour always, right? I was sometimes a bull in a china shop, and I would aggressively want to win every battle, right? You're going into everything to win. And as a very aggressive, you know, engineer who wanted to solve problems, who was maybe overly confident in their way of doing things, you know, I went through all of that process to be able to approve, you know, what I was doing. I was missing the bigger picture many times, right? When you walk in to something, many times you don't have to win the immediate battle to win the war, right? You know, just paraphrasing some, I can't remember who said that at one point in their war battles. And so when I look at Victory, what does that mean? It's not about making money. You know, I have enough money. It's only about what difference or impact have you made on the world, your life, your family's life, your employees' lives. What impact can you make? And so as I move forward, I don't worry about winning every battle. And quite frankly, through these pivots, I've had to lose a few battles, which, you know, were quite painful. But I have been able to fundamentally change medicine. Advil's definition of what medicine is now the definition of almost every doctor I've ever met. And they look at us as leaders in shaping the future of healthcare. And we have the capability to cut 50% of the cost out of our healthcare system. And when you think about what's happening, there's two major issues in healthcare that are really cratering the country. Number one is access. People who need access to healthcare can't always have access for whatever reason, maybe location, maybe cost, whatever it may be. And the second is the cost. Even if they have access, the government is going bankrupt through it, companies are going bankrupt from it, and families are going bankrupt from it. And so it's literally impossible to provide adequate healthcare to everyone. Well, if you cut 50% of the cost out of medicine, the government actually spends 50% of the cost of healthcare in the United States today between Medicare and Medicaid. And so the government could actually give free healthcare to everyone in the United States with its current spend if everyone just adopted Advil. And that has revolutionary impacts on what it can give back to society and what victory actually looks like for this company and for me, myself personally.
Wow, that would be incredible. As you look back at your younger self, is there any advice you'd give to your past self?
It's really the biggest advice that I would want to give myself is that don't get frustrated with progress. I mean, my number one probably fault is I'm impatient. And you can look at that as a strength, actually, in many areas. But for me personally, it's probably been one of my faults. There's never enough time. You have to have that sense of urgency. Losing that sense of urgency, it will kill you, right? Lack of sense of urgency is maybe one of the number one reasons people fail in their careers. But you have to have patience to allow things to develop in your customers, in your technology. And having impatience, but patience, is something that I've had to learn over time. And it's cost me dearly as I've gone through my career when I forced things that weren't ready. And then we end up losing business, or the technology ends up breaking. We have a bad launch, you know, whatever it may be. So there's that healthy trade-off that a younger James could probably learn from.
Well, patience is a virtue, as they say. And I like this idea of conscious patience if it doesn't come naturally to us.
It's the conscious patience. Absolutely.
Well, James, this has been such a fantastic conversation. Thank you for spending the time with us. Thank you for sharing more about Advil. Really excited to see about all the transformative changes you're bringing to the healthcare industry. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel. I really appreciate you having me today.
Okay, we're done. I forgot to tell you at the start to not leave. I'm glad you didn't just immediately click out. Great job. That was wonderful. I mean, it comes through, and we talked about your storytelling as well, but you're so articulate and good at really getting to the why of each of my questions, let alone of describing why the why is important. So that was really wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to support it.
Absolutely. So from here, we'll send this over to the production team. It'll take them probably 3 or 4 weeks or so to get up and running, ready for publication. We'll let you know when it is posted. So you can send it to all of your channels, friends and family. And in the meantime, I think I saw in your survey that you did have an interest in potentially scheduling a call with Travis to see if there might be, you know, something there with maybe writing a book. I thought that you had a lot of really great anecdotes in our conversation just now, and you clearly thought about outlining sort of three key points of some important parts of scaling business, of hiring or, you know, things like that. So if that's of interest, I'd be happy to find some time for you to connect with them.
Yeah. I mean, I will write a book, eventually. I'm probably not going to do it right away. So happy to have the call with him. But it's, you know, I try to stay really focused.
Yeah.
And but I definitely do plan to write a book. You know, I've got a number of things that, you know, I don't know if anyone really wants to read it, but it's something that I would like to document at least.
Absolutely. How does your schedule look next week?
I'm traveling next week. So next week is not good.
Not that. How about early July?
The week of the 7th is open.
The 7th. Okay. And you're mountain time, right?
I'm Pacific time right now.
Okay. Whatever would be easy. Okay, we'll do Pacific time. Do you have the 7th, would noon work?
The 7th at noon can work, yes.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I'll get you guys on the calendar and we'll get that set up. That should be it. Okay, great. I'll get that linked up. Well, it was wonderful to connect today. Thank you so much again for your time. And I'm really excited for this to be published. I think people are really going to love it.
All right, Rachel. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, bye.